Welcome to If Then, the show about how technology is changing our lives and our future. I'm April Glazer.
And I'm Will Arimus.
Okay, welcome to If Then. We're coming to you from Slate and Future Tense, a partnership between Slate, Arizona State University, and New America. We are recording this on the afternoon of Tuesday, May 29th.
On today's show, we'll talk about Europe's sweeping new online privacy rules, which went into effect last Friday, triggering an avalanche of emails to your inbox.
Then we'll be joined by John Carreyrou, a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter with The Wall Street Journal. His new book, Bad Blood, chronicles his investigation into Theranos, the now disgraced blood testing startup, which sold faulty machines that potentially put people's lives in danger. We'll get the scoop from Carreyrou on this bizarre story, and we'll talk about what it tells us about how Silicon Valley throws money around, and whether venture capitalists and investors are poised to make such an epic mistake again.
And we'll close, we promise, with Don't Close My Tabs, our favorite stories from the web this week. All right, April, how's it going this week?
It's okay. It's summertime. How you doing, Will?
I'm doing well, thanks. And I'm excited because we have a voice memo here from one of our listeners. You know, we've been asking listeners to email us or send us a comment or a voice memo with some question about something we talked about on the show. Well, we have one from Matthew in Texas, who's responding to our recent show in which we talked about the merger between AT&T and Time Warner and what the antitrust ramifications of that might be. Let's go ahead and listen to Matthew's clip right now.
So I live in a rural part of South Texas, and the only internet provider is AT&T in my area. I work online. I'm very computer-centric. A lot of what I do revolves around the internet. So AT&T, often in my area, will have constant service outages, or at times they do not meet my work needs. In the extreme cases, they don't even have service at all. So what I'm afraid of is that this AT&T merger will have absolutely no incentive to give better service or quality to its least served communities. When it is the only service in that area, I just can't imagine anything getting better.
Matthew, you bring up some really good points, and I'm very grateful for you for listening and taking the time to send us a voice memo and write us as you did. So thanks so much for that. And you are very right to be concerned about AT&T consolidating power and how that will affect places that are already poorly served, right? So when you're in a situation where there's only one broadband provider, or even if there's only two broadband providers, but in the case that you're talking about, there's only one, and I relate to that too, because I just got broadband internet for my home in Oakland, California, in the Bay Area. And the only option I had for high-speed internet, at least on my block, was Comcast. I tried to see what the AT&T option was, and they said that they don't serve my block. It's just Comcast. So with you, even though I'm not in a rural area, and when we do see consolidation of power from these companies, they do not have an incentive to provide better service, particularly in places where it's expensive to maybe run fiber out, and houses are very far apart. And, you know, they might get less money in subscription fees than they would in building that infrastructure. Then they're like super not incentivized to build out and serve the information needs of people. And, you know, your concern about AT&T getting even more power and then being able to kind of sit on their hands and not fix the infrastructure that they have out there is absolutely correct. Without other competitors out there, they have no one that's really going to take their business from them. So I really appreciate you bringing in your perspective on this. And we are going to continue to follow this merger case because it is a big deal that will very much reshape how we are able to get information. So thanks for that again.
And you don't have to think that AT&T is a villain to see the problem here. I mean, it's a market failure. I mean, private companies, when we rely on private companies for internet, I think this is a problem we're going to have. And maybe public broadband is something we could talk about more on the show in the future.
I think you can see AT&T as a villain. I disagree. They have a huge lobbying shop. They've worked really, really hard to create these market conditions. And I don't think that there's any reason not to look to them for the structure that they've asked for so many years.
All right. And now we're going to shift to another place where the government is getting involved in regulating technology companies. April, tell us what's going on with GDPR. Everybody's talking about it. I don't know that everybody fully understands what it actually is or why we're getting all these emails from every online service that we've ever used.
Right. And so GDPR, or expanded, it's the General Data Protection Regulation. It's the broad set of new online privacy rules at the EU. These rules were actually adopted 2 years ago by the European Parliament in 2016. But as of Friday, they went into law across the pond. They are now in effect. And like I said, companies had 2 years to kind of figure out how they would comply. The new laws are the strongest online privacy laws in the world, and they did spark an avalanche of emails in your inbox, as we said this morning, because in order to comply with the new laws, companies had to change their privacy policy, their data collection policies, and in doing so, they alerted everybody that things had changed.
All right, so what new rights are people in the EU getting, and which part of those benefits, if any, can Americans who use these same services expect to get?
Well, it's hard to know what Americans can expect to get because we don't have any corresponding privacy rights. So the answer to that is zero. You shouldn't expect anything. But, you know, we might get some things just by dint of the internet being kind of borderless. But now if you're an EU citizen and, you know, you use the internet, you can request to see the data that companies hold on you, and you can demand to get that data deleted. Companies now also need to get permission from the people they collect data on before using it. And so basically, this is just about having more personal rights over data on you, the data that you inadvertently create as you use the internet. The new law also requires advertisers to get explicit consent from users to target ads to them, like based on their religious beliefs or their ethnicity or their political affiliation or their sexual orientation. And in general, ad companies like Google and Facebook and other smaller ones are going to have to jump through more hoops to target ads to people based on their personal details, like their relationship status. And so it might mean, we don't know, but advertising might start looking more like magazine ads, where they just have less of a sense of who they're actually targeting, you know, and it's a kind of a broader bucket. That depends on really how these companies are able to engineer the consent that they get. So if, you know, we still click yes to agreeing to all of these things, then, we might not see much difference in the EU than what we have here, except for the fact that users can ask for more demands of how their data is used, should they wish. But we might see some sort of consent regime where you just click agree.
Yeah, and I saw at least some indication on Twitter. I don't know if this is true, but they were showing screenshots of companies that appeared to be using little dots on your notification icon to make it seem like you had messages waiting for you, so that you would go ahead and click through and just say agree to get back to using the service.
Yeah, I'm not sure exactly how that was set up or if it is the case, but there's all kinds of ways for a company to coax us to click past and get going and agree to who knows what. And that might be what they engineer to get our consent here. Another thing that's important to note with the GDPR rules, and, you know, I'll say, just to piggyback on what I just said, although they might be able to get consent quickly, people do have more privacy rights, right? So you can say, stop collecting my data. In fact, let me see what you've got. Okay, now I would like you to delete it. We can't do that in the U.S. I can't ask a company to do that if I'm unhappy with how creepy it is to use the internet these days, because whenever I talk about something, all of a sudden there's an ad online for whatever I was just talking about. I know that's conspiracy theory stuff, but people say it happens, and I feel like this contextual advertising is something that people might want to request that they're not participating in. What I was going to say, though, is that if these companies are found in violation, so if they are caught holding on to data that you requested they delete, or if they don't hand over the data that you asked for, or they're targeting to you based on things that you have somehow expressed that they shouldn't be targeting you on, they can get fined 20 million euros, or about 24 million US dollars, or 4% of their global revenue for the year, whichever is higher. That could cost a company as big as Google over $2 billion. So they have hired hundreds of people, maybe even thousands, but I know at least hundreds of people to figure out compliance with these GDPR rules. And it's really hit folks. You know, the LA Times, the Chicago Tribune, the Arizona Daily Star, all owned by Trunk, the media conglomerate. Those papers are not available in Europe right now. because they didn't figure out their privacy compliance soon enough. So European users are getting a note that says we'll be back shortly.
Yeah, and I have no sympathy for Trunk and its constituent papers. That's a big company that's been really relentlessly focused on streamlining journalism to the detriment of the actual work, in my opinion, to try to wring more profits out of their papers. But that said, it does bring up a point here, which is that the biggest tech companies like Facebook and Google have those teams of lawyers. They are able to comply. It's not going to really hurt them. One of the concerns is that it's the smaller companies, the small publishers, the small online services that don't have big legal teams to comply with this regulation that could be hurt by it more than the giants. You could even get an increasing amount of lock-in with the biggest tech companies that are able to satisfy these requirements.
Or maybe companies should just stop trying to make money based on our private data and stop collecting it and stick to whatever online service they're offering that might not require such massive troves of data collection. But it is going to be harder for smaller companies. And you know, these are the most robust online privacy laws in the world, and it's new. And we're going to keep following how it goes. All right, time for a quick break. When we come back, we'll have our interview with journalist John Carreyrou about his groundbreaking reporting on the Silicon Valley company Theranos.
Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank, USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Our guest today is John Carreyrou, a 2-time Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter with The Wall Street Journal, who recently published a book, Bad Blood, Secrets and Lies in a Silicon Valley Startup. It's about his investigation into Theranos, a blood testing firm helmed by CEO Elizabeth Holmes. Her company, thanks to Carreyrou's reporting, has been accused of fraud by federal regulators like the Securities and Exchange Commission. Theranos claimed to have developed a machine that could perform the full range of hundreds of laboratory tests from a simple finger prick extracting a drop or two of blood, a claim that, if true, would have completely revolutionized lab testing and diagnostics for the entire healthcare industry. But it wasn't true. After months of reporting, Carreyrou discovered that the blood testing instrument marketed by Theranos could only perform a handful of tests, and the rest were sent to outside labs or even returned with potentially inaccurate results. Still, Theranos was able to court nearly $1 billion in funding when Carreyrou first reported on the company and attract partnerships with Safeway and Walgreens to put the Theranos faulty blood testing devices in their stores. John, let's start with how Theranos was able to get so far. Their investors apparently didn't do the due diligence on the company, and neither did these multi-billion-dollar companies like Safeway and Walgreens. I don't really get how Theranos was able to get so far with what was essentially a prop. And I don't really understand what these investors asked or didn't ask. Maybe you can help us.
Well, the company is at this point a 15-year-old company. When she first dropped out of Stanford, Elizabeth Holmes was 19, and she dropped out in the middle of her sophomore year. And at first, you know, the early investors, people like Tim Draper and Larry Ellison and Don Lucas, they were investing in a vision and a young entrepreneur, just like there are a lot of startups that start out with nothing and just a vision. And so they were playing the odds. You know, most startups fail eventually. The fraud started really taking shape later in the company's life when around 2010, Elizabeth approached Walgreens and Safeway and maintained to them that her device was ready and that it could do all these tests off just a drop of blood. And that was just not the case at all. And eventually she rolled out the finger stick tests commercially in Walgreens stores in the fall of 2013, late summer and early fall of 2013. And based on that rollout, she solicited more funding. And this is when the company raised the lion's share of the money. So when you talk about the close to $1 billion that the company raised over its history, $700 million of that was raised after they rolled out the finger stick tests in Walgreens stores and pretended that they had new technology that worked when in fact they didn't. But you mentioned something else that's relevant here, which is that in the last years when she raised most of the money, there were very few. In fact, I can't think of a single sophisticated VC that had experience in medical technology or the life sciences. The people that she approached and that she was able to raise money from were these billionaires and these billionaire families who were not sophisticated investors, who had no expertise in laboratory science and who did not do due diligence.
And so those investors were the Waltons. Can you give us a short list?
Right. So the Walton family, via two investment vehicles, invested $150 million. Rupert Murdoch was the single biggest investor. He invested $125 million. The Coxes, the billionaire Cox family in Atlanta that controls Cox Enterprises, invested $100 million. Betsy DeVos's family, our current education secretary, invested $100 million. Carlos Slim, the Mexican billionaire, invested $30 million. A San Francisco hedge fund called Partner Fund Management invested almost $100 million. And its top two executives actually did try to do some due diligence and met with Elizabeth Holmes and Sonny Balwani several times in late 2013 and early 2014. And they were just outright lied to. They were given profit and revenue projections that were really fictitious, that had no grounding whatsoever in reality. They were shown data that was not data, clinical data that was not clinical data from the Theranos devices. They were really hoodwinked. So even the investors who did try to do diligence were just bald-faced lied to.
All right. So the specifics of this story are fascinating. You write in your book about all the intrigue within the company as it grew and attracted investors. You talk about the secrecy and paranoia with which Holmes ran the company, how she surrounded herself with yes men and fired anybody who raised questions. I guess she started consciously dressing like Steve Jobs pretty early on. It's a great read, a great story in its own right. But let's talk a little bit about what's systemic here. I mean, is there something about Silicon Valley and the machinery of the startup industry that allowed this to happen? And has anything changed since then? I mean, what's preventing us from having another Theranos that makes headlines and magazine covers with a product that isn't really doing what it claims to do?
Well, I would say yes, that Theranos is the symptom of a systemic problem. You had this enormous bubble that formed over the past 10 years, and a big reason for it is that the Federal Reserve kept rates low for a decade, and investors looked for higher returns in places other than, you know, traditional investments like bonds, and they turned their sights in particular to Silicon Valley. And so these enormous flows of money started rushing into the Valley ecosystem, and this money started being thrown at young college dropouts like Elizabeth. And they were able to pick and choose who they accepted money from, and they were able to not answer questions and not let investors do proper due diligence, because they could just turn to another investor if there were too many questions asked that they didn't like. They were granted too much power in some cases. You know, Elizabeth controlled more than 99% of the voting rights. The board of Theranos couldn't even reach a quorum without her. So it is a symptom of something systemic. And it's really this huge sub-economy now in the Valley that's grown up in the past 10 years. The feeling among startup founders and VCs was that the laws that apply to other companies that are public don't apply to private companies. this is where the SEC cracking down matters. And I think the thing that bears watching now is what the U.S. Attorney's Office in San Francisco will do. It's been conducting a criminal investigation of this affair for more than 2 years. And my sources tell me that that investigation is very well advanced, that it's drawing to a close, and that it may well result in criminal indictments of Elizabeth Holmes and Sonny Balwani.
You know, and even the more seasoned Silicon Valley investors, I mean, they say yes to things that they don't understand, too. I reported on a company, a Lilly drone, a startup that got, you know, $15 million in funding from high-profile VC firms like Spark Capital and Slow Ventures and Sherpa Capital. And they were selling a product that didn't exist and couldn't really exist by engineering standards, and they got money for it. It seems like there is a culture amongst investors, or maybe it's this kind of Silicon Valley optimism where they're just like, yeah, we can do it. It's not real yet, but we can do it. But when it comes to medical devices, that's just really scary. I'm curious, did anyone's really like lives get at risk from this? This was like people getting bad results back, right?
Yeah, I came across in my reporting more than a dozen instances where people got questionable results, and you know, some health scares occurred, as I detail in my book. One patient got sent to the emergency room on the eve of Thanksgiving, and I believe it was 2014, and ended up you know, getting a battery of tests, and eventually they figured out by testing her blood again at the hospital that the Theranos results were wrong, but her doctor was initially worried that she might be on the cusp of a stroke. So that there were patients whose lives were affected by this. I think that had the company expanded nationally, as it was on the cusp of doing when I came along with my stories, it was on the cusp of expanding the partnership with Walgreens to the whole country and to Walgreens' more than 8,000 stores, then I think the chances that someone would really have gotten hurt would have increased dramatically.
You know, Silicon Valley was started partly by, you know, with Shockley Semiconductor, and the idea that you didn't have to be, you didn't have to have all the credentials in order to start a company. You just had to have the idea and the ability. You had to be able to build something cool or important, and you could start your own company without being an established player. That obviously has led to some wonderful things, but has that ethos been taken too far these days in Silicon Valley? I mean, now you end up with a guy like Mark Zuckerberg, who's good at coding, making decisions about how elections around the world will be run.
Right. I'd say the big difference with Mark Zuckerberg's company, Facebook, is that it is it's an internet. It started out as a website. Now it's mostly a smartphone app, and it's a social media, but it's not a medical device that doctors and patients are relying on for important health decisions. And so, you know, when Facebook was rolled out for the first time, it had bugs. Twitter was famous for having bugs and outages that would sometimes last days at a time. That didn't have any consequences on the health of patients. Users, of course, were frustrated and angry, but that was about the extent of it. So I think when you get into the realm of medicine and you start importing that make it till you fake it ethos, or that, you know, let's iterate ethos, I think you quickly reach the limits of that. It's possible to do it with software, with computer software. The term vaporware was coined in the early 80s to refer to computer software or hardware that was announced with great fanfare by a company and then, you know, either never materialized or materialized years later and without the features that were promised. And Larry Ellison was famous for that in the early days of Oracle. But you can't use that attitude in the medical arena. You can't mess around with people's lives.
One character I want to ask about is Ramesh Sunny Balwani, or Sunny as he goes by. He and Elizabeth Holmes were romantically involved. They met when she was very, very young, right? Like when she was just a freshman at Stanford, and he was
the summer before her freshman year. So she was 18 when they met.
Right. And he was already kind of a seasoned Silicon Valley kind of tech entrepreneur at that time. That's to me sounds like, and I don't want to project anything, the recipe for a somewhat manipulative relationship, you know, when you do have, you know, such big discrepancies in age and expertise and, you know, someone who is wants to be a entrepreneur so badly. I'm curious if you could discuss kind of where he stands now in this and kind of his role. Maybe we should start with that, his role in building the company and where they both stand now that the company is in this kind of dissolving phase.
Right. So he started out as her friend and then her mentor. And eventually by 2005, at the latest, they were in a romantic relationship and they were living together in a condo that he owned in Palo Alto. I would push back actually pretty strongly against the notion that he manipulated her and that he was like her Svengali. Really, it was a partnership of equals. And if anything, she had the last say. And I say this from having talked to dozens of employees who saw them close up working together. She was in control the whole time. And so, yes, you know, there's a 19-year age difference between them. But she was not his tool. They were doing this together and they were perpetrating this fraud together. As to where he is now, he, unlike her and unlike Theranos, has not settled the SEC charges. He's fighting them in a federal court in California. They are no longer a couple. She actually fired him in the spring of 2016. And broke up with him and moved out from the house that they were living in Atherton. And they haven't been a couple since then. And their lawyers, I'm told, have been discouraging them from communicating because of the ongoing criminal investigation.
John, I'm curious if you think that this is going to be a real lesson learned for Silicon Valley. I am not sure that it necessarily will be. It seems like maybe this is being read more as an aberration and less of a cue to investors to really dig deep. Or do you get a different sense?
I hope it's a lesson that stays with Silicon Valley. And I hear that, you know, that it is a story that has really shocked people, and that venture capitalists in particular out there have, a lot of them have drawn some lessons from this. On the other hand, you have a guy like Tim Draper, who as recently as a couple of weeks ago was on CNBC defending her and refusing to acknowledge that Holmes had done anything wrong and calling me a badger and a hyena for exposing this fraud. And I think, you know, people like Draper are really the epitome of what's wrong with Silicon Valley. These are people who think that just because, you know, someone has a bold vision and is an entrepreneur, that excuses wrongdoing, that it excuses financial shenanigans, that excuses misleading investors and committing securities fraud, and that excuses putting patients' health in harm's way. And I don't think that, you know, being an entrepreneur with a bold vision excuses any of that. If you're an entrepreneur in Silicon Valley, you still have to go by the rules of society and you can't commit fraud.
Yeah. And it is remarkable that for venture capital, which is an industry built on disrupting industries and disrupting people's livelihoods, it's amazing when you deal with these people and find out how thin-skinned they are and how allergic they are to any kind of criticism. So I say for my part, here's to the badgers and the hyenas in the media, because that's, you know, it was your work that helped to bring down Theranos. And it was not all the glossy magazine covers that were celebrating Elizabeth Holmes as the next Steve Jobs that were gonna accomplish that and keep people safe. John Carreyrou, thank you so much for joining us on If Then.
Thanks very much for having me.
One final break and then don't close my tabs. Some of the best stories we saw online this week.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity, much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save, too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at Progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Okay, so for tabs, we're going to talk about a little drama first. Will, why don't you update us on what's happening in the world of Elon Musk?
All right. Yeah, the tab that I could not close this past week, against my better judgment, was this Twitter flame war between hero entrepreneur Elon Musk and the media, or people claiming to speak for the media. Musk.
That would be us. That's
including me, actually. I jumped into this maybe inadvisably. But Musk was set off by a number of negative stories about Tesla, the most recent of which was an investigation by the nonprofit Reveal into worker safety issues at Tesla's factories. Musk felt that the reporting was inaccurate. He felt that the headlines were sensational. In general, Tesla's been getting more bad press than it's used to lately. This is a company that was hyped wildly by the media for years and years, and now there's a sort of backlash in force. And Musk is really mad about it. So he started tweeting about the media's, quote, holier-than-thou attitude. He said the reason people voted for Trump is because, quote, no one believes you anymore, and you lost your credibility a long time ago. And he proposed a new site that he wants to call Pravda.com, where people can go on and rate the credibility of individual journalists and publications and even editors. And then that's supposed to somehow sort out this systemic problem whereby the media sensationalizes stories and reports things that are inaccurate and in Musk's view, gets away with it.
You know, I want to push back on calling the media backlash against Musk. There's been a lot of very important reporting on real-world harms by his company and companies that, you know, he owns and runs and has for many years. And those companies are becoming bigger and they're starting to put cars on the road and they are starting to meet more consumer demands. And as that has happened, people have been getting hurt, whether it is through accidents in the Teslas or it's in the factory where workers, according to reporting, have not been taken care of properly and their safety concerns have not been met. And that has made Musk angry that people are reporting on his companies. And really, this is what the press is supposed to do. So I wouldn't say that there's been a backlash against him. I'd say that his companies are getting bigger and people are watching them more closely. And that could be a healthy relationship. But instead, he is starting a website, he says, or a company or some sort of, who knows if it'll come to fruition, but some sort of project to rate journalists. And he's calling it Pravda, which was the official paper of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union for most of the 20th century. And Joseph Stalin used it to perpetuate anti-Semitic messages and also to justify the Great Purge, which was a campaign of political oppression that led to the state-sanctioned deaths of hundreds of thousands of Russians. So great choice of name there, Musk, really evoking a lot there in relation to the press.
Yeah, I kind of wondered about that choice of name, if he intends it ironically. If so, it doesn't really, the joke isn't really landing for me. But maybe that's because I'm one of those biased members of the media. I think to the extent that Musk has any point here, it's that the reporting on crashes involving Tesla's autopilot software has tended to be sort of breathless. Now, anytime a Tesla is involved in a serious accident, it makes national news. He's upset because, of course, cars made by other companies crash all the time, and it doesn't make national news. I think that's kind of silly because obviously autopilot is a new technology. I mean, it's a step towards self-driving cars. It's crazy to think that the media would not report critically on how safe that technology actually is. But that's where he's coming from. He feels like, look, I'm trying to save lives here. And every time there's a slight accident involving this fundamentally life-saving technology, the press doesn't put it in context and instead makes it seem like my technology is killing people.
And, you know, just to be clear, the press does cover other car companies and does cover large crashes. You know, Toyota was sued in 2010 for a fatal crash that led to the recall of 8.5 million cars. That was covered broadly. In 2016, the Star Trek actor was killed in a Chrysler, which led to the recall of over a million cars. That was covered broadly. You know, it's a new technology here. And also, he developed a cult of personality around himself that led to a lot of positive coverage for a very long time. And you can't just renege on that and say, oh, well, you know, now you can't cover me at all, especially when there's bad stuff happening. So, you know, if other car companies were started by, like, Danny DeVito or, I don't know, who has a cult of personality around them, then, you know, we might cover that really, really closely because people are interested in Elon Musk for a reason. But, you know, his lash against the media, I think, was dangerous. Because so many people do follow him closely and look up to him as a leader, as an entrepreneur. They say, oh, well, not everyone in the tech industry is so bad because, you know, look at what Musk is doing. He's this environmentalist. He's working really hard to make things better. And people really took to him. And when he says that the media is evil or bad or not working well or working against us or biased, regardless, you know, people listen to him closely, and when he says negative things about the press and says that the press can't be trusted, people listen to him and care about what he says. And this is at a time when journalism is playing a very, very important role in the country, and we do not need leaders like him throwing this kind of democracy-saving profession into question. So that's my opinion on it. Whether or not what his motives were, what he's doing is dangerous. So.
Yeah, and of course, there always will be sensationalism in the media. There always will be inaccuracy. My concern is that he's painting with this very broad brush in much the same way that President Trump does, where he makes it seem like the media is one monolithic entity that's trying to mislead people. And of course, what that does is it undermines the ability of legitimate outlets to tell true stories and to report critically on what's going on in the world.
Elon Musk, you have to be able to take some criticism a little better, dude.
You've done a lot of great stuff, and the media has praised you a lot. So yes, learn to take a little criticism along with all the praise. All right, April, what tab could you not close this week?
My tab is from this weekend. It's a story from the New York Times. As Google feeds cats, owl lovers cry foul. So there is this operation, I guess, at Google to rescue cats, to feed cats. Cats are traditionally hunt birds in the area where Google is based in Mountain View, California. And there is some tension around a particular bird that is quite endangered called the burrowing owl. These cats that Google has been feeding have been preying on, and that has caused a lot of drama. The burrowing owl is an important figure in the drama around at least land use in Silicon Valley. Mountain View politicians have claimed that because of this bird, they have opposed more housing being built throughout Mountain View because they don't want to infringe on kind of the habitat of this endangered species. As a result, a lot of Googlers and people in the area have found housing elsewhere, driving prices up. It's a complicated bird, and now it seems like Google's cat rescue is making things even more complicated for it. I really encourage people to read this because it is a piece of drama that really adds a lot of color to how these companies just affect everything around them in every way, including owls and cats.
And I liked how the story specified that, like, it's another case of people with the best intentions, but they're just, Google is so large and has such a large footprint that they can't help affecting the world around them in unintended ways.
I want housing, I want cats. I also want to save endangered owls. So I guess I want it all. That does it, though, for our show this week. You can get updates about what's coming up next by following us on Twitter at IfThenPod. You can also email us at ifthen@slate.com. Send us your tech questions, show and guest suggestions, or just say hello.
You can follow April and me on Twitter as well. I'm at Will Arimus, and April is at April Laser. Thanks again to our guest, John Carreyrou. You can find him on Twitter at John Carreyrou.
And if you'd take a precious moment to leave us a precious comment and review on iTunes, we would be so grateful forever. It really helps boost our show, and it lets more listeners find out about us. So thanks in advance.
If Then is a production of Slate and Future Tense, a partnership between Slate, Arizona State University, and New America. Our producer is Max Jacobs. Thanks to Don Aulis at A Room with a VU in Santa Barbara.
And thanks to Jesse Nichols at Fantasy Studios in Berkeley. We'll see y'all next week.